Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
The Top Water crew here. We're just still trying to get our heads around what happened on day three of that first Australia-India test, and what better way to do it than call in one of the best cricket writers in the business to help us make sense of it all. Formerly with the Indian Express and now with Crick Buzz, our guest is also a Penguin Random House author, publishing the Dhoni Touch in 2018. He's currently joining us from Melbourne as he prepares for the Boxing Day test. Bharat Sundaresan, welcome to the Top Water podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. That was a very, very sweet welcome. And yeah, here we are in crazy 2020 doing crazy things.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no better way to start then than that crazy first test. I mean, 2 days in, it seemed like we were really poised for a tight contest. And then just in a few crazy, incredible overs, all the predictions went out the window. And I mean, has the reality of that second inning sunk in for you?
Not at all. I've not even gotten time for it to sink in, you know, because, yeah, like you guys said, on that third morning, I was gearing up for a great test finish. I was like, wow, India ahead by 62 runs. The ball's still doing stuff. Maybe they'll get bowled out for 150, 160. Then Australia, like, you know, look to chase down 220. And as cricket journalists, we all are the same. We all wish for a three-day finish, which never happens. We want the 2 days off. But, you know, and the way that test match was headed, we knew day five would be difficult. But none of us, or I had absolutely no idea, no clue how that was going to play out. And in a way, guys, but we are lucky that it played out the way it did. Because if the game hadn't finished that day the way it did, that might have been the end of the series for me, because I had been in Sydney after December 11th covering the warm-up game. And the borders shut, like Victoria shut their borders with for whoever had been in New South Wales on Sunday night. So if the day, game hadn't finished on Saturday and lasted the distance, that would have been it for me. So in a way, thank you, India.
Yeah, well, that's good, I guess. We've got to take some positives to that from an Indian point of view. I mean, so you were at the ground. Did you manage to get a glimpse of the Indian camp as all those wickets were tumbling? What was going on? Like mad rush for the pads and all that stuff?
Oh, no, I'm a good journalist, guys, which means I'm an eavesdropper and a stalker. So my binoculars were always like, you know, turned towards the Indian dugout or whatever little I could see. They were all in shock. At one point, I remember, I think it was Ashwin, who's like scrambling down, just trying to get ready, because things were happening so quickly. And like I said, it was a crazy morning. Like the moment we entered, there was a security lady, which had, we heard a list of like, you know, all the suburbs in New South Wales, which had been affected. So she was asking me, oh, have you been to any of these? I said, no, I haven't. And I asked her, what would happen if I had been? Oh, we just call the cops and they take you to a motel and you quarantine. Oh my God. Yeah. So that's the thought I went with up to the press box. And by the time, and India actually had a long huddle that morning. It was a 7 minute huddle. I counted actually the time or just calculated the time. And Virat Kohli spoke for 5 minutes, and nobody would have known that that would have been his last day of the tour. And it was all gearing up perfectly. And then, like, you know, Jasprit Bumrah gets out and we're still talking about, oh, our travel plans to Melbourne. When do we go? When do we leave? And then Pujara goes and you're still like, ah, well, whatever, Pujara, good ball, great ball. Mm-hmm. Next over, Agarwal's gone. Next, and you're like, wait, I think we should be watching this game a little more keenly. So that's when the binoculars came out. And I'm looking at the Indian camp. Like I said, Ashwin's running down. Everybody's just like, they were just in shock. I think they're still in shock. I'm still in shock. Like, you know, you don't get to see collapses like that. It was a new for me. I saw England collapse for 67 last year during the Ashes, but 36 all out. At some point, you kept thinking, look, something's going to happen here. One partnership, right? And especially that Virat Kohli dismissal when he stood around to see if Cambrian had taken the catch cleanly. We've been in those positions before, right? I knew, that's it. Definitely the ball would have been grounded. This is it. Kohli's going to stick around and India is going to make a game of it. But it just didn't stop the rot. It was just amazing.
And what did you make as a whole of their Indian batting performance in the second innings? Obviously 36 all out or 36 for nine is not an ideal scenario for them. But what do you put it down to? Was it maybe a bit of lack of application from their top six batters, or were Cummins and Hazelwood just far too good on the day and their every ball that the Indian guys got had their name on it?
I think it's more the latter than the former, guys. And I'm not even trying to make excuses for the Indian team here because, A, I'm an Australian correspondent, by the way. So, no, but even honestly, I think this, what happened, like right now, everybody's talking about 36 all out. But retrospectively, I'm very sure this will be looked back at as the one of the greatest spells of seam bowling ever. Because, you know, we've seen bowlers like historically, yeah, they'll have a great, what do you constitute as a great spell? Yeah, oh, he's been beating the bat so much. Oh, if only he had a little more luck, he would have had a couple of wickets, is what you would generally say about a great spell. But here there were no plays and misses. Like in the sense, every time they pitched it and got the Indians to play at it, they got the edge, the catch was taken. So I think this is the kind of spell that a bowler dreams of. And then you had two at either end having these dream spells. And if you look at the dismissals, the deliveries that Pujara got or Vihari got or even Agarwal got, I think most batsmen would have gotten out to those. Ajinkya Rahane maybe could have moved his front foot a little down the pitch, but he is jittery early on, like a lot of batsmen. Virat Kohli's shot, yeah, I mean, you could criticize it, but you know, at that point, I thought he was just, I expected him to go on the counter-attack. So I don't know what to put it down to. I just think it was extraordinary bowling. And like, you know, it was like the Indians were a little like a kangaroo, like, you know, in front of the headlights. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what hit them, but I think it's kind of easier to, in my opinion, to get over a defeat of this nature where it's just shock rather than a grinding, debilitating defeat where the team is just like, you know, scored 600 runs and you've been bowled out. Because if you look at the session-wise breakdown, which a lot of broadcasters like to do, India dominated that test match, right? In many ways. And it was all blown away in 92 minutes.
And what's been the talk out of the Indian camp since? I mean, I imagine they'll be keen to put that 36 for nine down as an aberration and move on. But there are some things that they'll need to have a look at and maybe make adjustments taking away from that game. And you mentioned all of the catches went to hand for Australia in that second innings, not quite the same in Australia's first batting innings for India.
Yeah, I think that is what really, really hurt them. Because in cricket, you can have a horrid day with the bat, like a team. We've not seen days as horrid as the ones we experienced on Saturday at the Adelaide Oval, but it's the catches that really, really hurt them because Australia managed to keep the lead, India's lead down to 53. But if Manas's catches were taken, even a couple of them, or even one of them, and Tim Payne's drop was extremely expensive, right? Mm. Like he managed to put on 80 for the last two or three wickets. And the momentum kind of shifted towards Australia as a result. And also, if those catches had been taken, yes, India would have been sitting on a handsome lead or a much bigger lead. And also, they would have gotten to bat not just under light. They would have got some daylight to bat under. So maybe they would have had a better start to their innings. So the catches really, really hurt them. And you know, when it's India's ground fielding has improved dramatically in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, we've seen some extraordinary fielders come out of India. But when you see a team dropping catches like sitters the way they are, you have to start thinking about, I mean, it can't be technique at the highest level, right? It has to be mental. So again, I'm not making excuses, but this is a team which has been in a state of lockdown, a lot of these players for months now, starting from India when the virus hit, then in the UAE, then over here. Yeah, I mean, they've had a lot of freedom in Australia. They've been very, very fortunate to be here for sure. I don't know. I think it's more a mental thing, just the way they've been dropping catches. Batting wise, I guess they'll just want to forget about this, but the departure of Virat Kohli opens the door for Shubman Gill, someone who doesn't come into the next test with any baggage. And look, red ball, MCG, the pitch is a lot different. India did have a scheduled practice session yesterday at the Adelaide Oval, but it got rained off. So I think, in a way, it's not a bad thing. They come to Melbourne, they come, go to the MCG tomorrow morning, fresh start. And it's a venue where they more or less sealed the series last time around. So I think India will really want to look forward to, I mean, that's as cliched as it sounds. But, you know, it opens the doors for a lot of selection questions. Of course, in back home in India, people are calling for wholesale changes. They want Rahul Dravid to be shipped off to Australia to be batting coach. But, well, it's not possible in 2020 the way it is. I mean, there's also the Rohit Sharma question. I don't think he will be, definitely won't be ready for the second test. But he is suddenly being spoken of a savior come the third test, regardless of where that's played. But there will be changes, but wholesale changes, maybe not. But, you know, in all this, what has also been lost is the loss of Mohammad Shami, which I think is at some level worse than 36-9. Because he was the number 11. The innings ended with his arm being broken. Now, as we know, it's fractured and he's flying back. So India have lost Ishan Sharma, who was their control bowler, Mohammad Shami, who's your enforcer, and Kohli was going home anyway. So, yeah, they have been driven into a hole. But I guess all they can look forward to is Melbourne and happy memories from 2 years ago.
Yeah, what you mentioned that there's been that massive call for wholesale changes. What do you make of that? Like, are we overreacting too much? Because yeah, there's been calls for Jadeja to be back, for Punt to come in, for Gill, as you said, and just all these guys like Vihari to be dropped, and it just seems on the outside. I mean, obviously that was a really bad performance, but it does seem like maybe they're just getting a little bit too excited. As you say, they were on top of that test for five sessions.
Yeah, exactly. And no, I mean, Indian fans are very, very reactive. I mean, India is reactive as a country. We all are. I mean, we wear our emotions on our sleeves, on our collars, everywhere. Like, we are an emotional lot. Just watch a Bollywood movie if you don't believe me. So, we get very sentimental about a lot of things, especially cricket. And I'm not surprised that people are calling for wholesale changes. But having followed this team, especially this team management, the way they function, I don't think they will panic so soon. So Prithvi Shaw, for example, people are calling for the 21-year-old's head. Like, you guys would remember his innings in Christchurch. He made 60-odd and he looked great on a tricky pitch 10 months ago. And he got really enabled in the second innings from Pat Cummins. Second ball, Mitchell Starc, just a little swing going through the gap in the first inning. So do you drop someone that you've invested in for long term after one bad performance? I wouldn't think so. Shubman Gill will come in regardless now that Virat Kohli is going. Just a question of where he bats. I think he'll just fit into number four. But Hanuma Vihari batted number four in all four innings in India's warm-up game. So maybe they might stick with him. That remains to be seen. But I think dropping Vihari would also be unfair. The only question is if India do think that Ravindra Jadeja is fit. Like, I saw him go from sprinting to batting in the nets to even bowling in the middle before the day's play on Saturday. So if he is fit, then do you actually consider him as a batting all-rounder? Because his batting has really come along in the last couple of years. I mean, we know he made 3 triple hundreds in Ranji Trophy in domestic cricket. But in the last couple of years, he's averaged a lot with the bat. So maybe, and he is the kind of cricketer, he was in great form before he got injured and concussed. But, he comes in with great form. So does he just come in as a batting all-rounder? I'm not ruling that out yet. But Riddhiman Saha, I mean, I'm a huge Riddhiman Saha fan just for how he is on the field and, how good he is with the gloves. But great, he did not have a flash. Like, he wasn't the best behind the wickets. And, like, yeah, that shot in the second innings was forgettable. So just for that reason, maybe Rishabh Pant would come in. But wholesale changes, maybe not.
And you mentioned Prithvi Shaw before. Yeah, obviously, like, we've been, you know, talking about him before the IPL, and we were, you know, really expecting big things there. I mean, he did really make an impression when he was in New Zealand. But now it feels like it sort of feels like how we were looking at Jeet Raval for New Zealand last summer, when basically it felt like the Australians just had figured him out, and they'd kind of got in his head, and they were just talking about him. And I know there was a Mitchell Stark, I think, said, you know, that the lunches are great at Melbourne, or I can't remember the exact sledge, but it was fantastic, basically saying you won't be playing at Melbourne and this is your last game. Is Prithvi Shaw kind of equipped to deal with that? How is his, you know, mental state on that side of things?
You know what, I'm from Bombay originally, and I was covering cricket in Bombay for a long time. We've covered Prithvi Shaw from the time he was 5 or 6. Like, you know, we've been writing about him. So he is a child prodigy. Mm. And one thing that really stands out about him is he's fearless. And that's one thing the team management really appreciates about him. And by fearless, I mean, he will not get affected by things that people say to him, or even a performance like that. And I mean it in a good way. I'm not saying he doesn't care, but he's just made out of that kind of cloth where it won't affect him. He won't go to sleep having nightmares about Mitchell Stark or Pat Cummins. He will back himself to overcome whatever happened in Adelaide, in Melbourne. And that's how he always has been. Batting is something he's done. He spent most of his life doing, like, most of his 21 years has been spent batting from the time he was 3 or 4. So I don't see mental scars in Prithvi Shaw. Maybe some others, I don't know, but definitely not in Prithvi Shaw.
We've only got a few days before the Boxing Day test in Melbourne. Plenty of food for thought for the Indian selectors, not least of which is having to replace both Virat Kohli and Mohammad Shami, who will be forced replacements, Kohli going home and now Mohammad Shami with a broken arm. Who do you think will come into that side from an Indian selector perspective? So putting on your hat of the Indian selectors, who's going to come in for Mohammad Shami? And you've already picked Shubman Gill as a straight replacement for Virat Kohli instead of KL Rahul?
Yeah, and please, like, I will not keep that selector's hat on for too long because it comes with a lot of brickbats. So an Indian selector is something I never want dream of being, because it's not easy. It definitely is not. So, but just for 30 seconds, I'll spend as an Indian selector, or in the shoes of an Indian selector, I'll say yes, Shubman Gill comes in for sure. Mohammad Siraj, really impressed with the red ball and the pink ball in the two games. So looks like he will come in, and I thought he bowled really well in the Blacktown practice game as well, where I was crawling through the bush and evading brown snakes to watch them practice through the net, like that's like a month back. So I think he looks like he has gone up in the pecking order ahead of Navdeep Saini, so he comes in. But I'm not ruling out a team Natarajan debut, maybe not in Melbourne, but sometime during this test series. Right now he is still in as part of the reserves. Like, he's just a net bowler alongside Shardul Thakur and young Kartik Tyagi. But just the way he's been bowling in the nets to Kohli, Pujara, Rahane, and just the way this tour has gone, he was supposed to be in no squad, but he's played T20 cricket, one-day cricket. Who knows? Like, you know, maybe there is a test to be there, but maybe not at the MCG. For now, Gill and Siraj for sure, but maybe there could be an opening for Jadeja as well.
And I mean, going back to that game, and you touched on a little bit before the pitch, what did you make of that pitch? Because, I mean, over here in New Zealand, there's been a lot of chat around pitches because I guess, you know, a lot of countries come here, our pitches are very different. Pakistan have mentioned it on their series, and West Indies did the same. That pitch in Adelaide, it seemed a little un-Australian for the first couple of days. Lyon was getting a lot of spin. I heard talk that the ground staff were leaving more on more grass on than usual to help look after the pink ball. Are you expecting sort of to go back to the, you know, that what we expect from an Australian pitch for the rest of the series?
I would think so, but the pitches in Australia these days have become so different to what they used to be. Like, the MCG has been, in fact, it's got a bad reputation in the last few years where it became too flat. I mean, we saw last year's Boxing Day test against New Zealand where it had something in it for the fast bowlers, which was a refreshing change. And of course, Tom Blundell made that wonderful 100, didn't he, on the last day of the test, where your Kiwi fans were created quite the atmosphere at the MCG or around the MCG. So I think that's the kind of pitch you might get. But the Adelaide Oval pitch was strange. I think it was the most sanitized pitch I've ever seen for a pink ball test in Adelaide, because like you said, it was turning. The bounce was odd. Some balls had carry, some balls didn't, but it really quickened up on that third day. And I just had a word with the curators on the sidelines after the test, and they seemed a little surprised with how quick it had become as well. So they expected the ball to do a little more on the first 2 days. It definitely did not. But that pitch, and the bounce did get a little uneven. So it was a strange pitch, to be honest. But a fair pitch. I think we saw some really good cricket. I think the MCG hopefully doesn't go back to its old self where it was really, really flat. But one thing is, to beat a subcontinental team in Australia, it's always good to play them on a flat pitch, because your bowlers know better how to take wickets on a flat pitch than the visiting team. So that's always an advantage that Australia carry.
And you're talking to two spinners here, so we do have to mention that awesome little battle between Lyon and Pujara on that day one. It was great viewing. Absolutely loved watching that and seeing it. It really seemed like Lyon was in Pujara's head a little bit there.
Oh, absolutely. And that was the battle that really set up the India-Australia series 2 years ago. And Pujara got the better of Lyon last time around. And historically, it's been a great battle. 2014-15, Lyon had the upper hand. Pujara changed his technique. He went more offside. He was using his feet a lot more, which he tried to do in Adelaide as well. But just by putting that silly point in, and that position came in for a lot of guys would remember 2 years ago, a lot of people, experts were like, why aren't they using the silly point more? So they did have it in place. It kind of seemed to have some effect on Cheteshwar Pujara. And yeah, and even Lyon and Kohli, they constantly seemed to be a competitive net that they were having. They were constantly in each other's ears. And I'm sure you guys would have enjoyed Ashwin to Manus as well. Because
absolutely.
Ashwin has had interesting visits to Australia in the past, but he was getting, and I'm sure, like as two spinners, you would have really appreciated the overspin he was getting on the ball, which is not very Ashwin. And the way he set Steve Smith up, the two balls where Steve Smith couldn't reach to the pitch of the ball. And like any batsman, he tried to play the third one off the back foot, and that the top spinner just bounced a little, got the outside edge. I think it was fascinating viewing, just watching the two off spinners. And look, it was only the second time in Test history that you had two off spinners with more than 350 wickets facing each other. So it was that, I think, before the 36 all out, for me, really stood out was Lyon to Kohli and Pujara and Ashwin to Manus.
Yeah, I mean, you recently wrote an excellent article about Ravi Ashwin, and you talked about him wanting to evolve his game. Is that addition of the more overspin in his repertoire something that he's evolved specifically to play in Australia? I feel like for the Indian team, if they're going to be competitive in Melbourne and particularly in Sydney, Ravi Ashwin is going to be massively important to their ability to knock Australia over quickly and skittle them for, under 250, 300 like they did in that first innings in Adelaide.
Yeah, definitely. And that is Ashwin. I mean, I called him a spin scientist in my copy. And that is who he has been over the years. He's never scared of experimentation. Like me, he is a Tamilian. He comes from the southern part of the country. And we are speaking of stereotypes, we're supposed to be the academicians. I'm not. He definitely is. but he goes about his spin bowling like it is. Like he is a scientist, like he is an academician. He's always constantly working on it. And it's been a criticism of him in the past where, experts or people who understand spin bowling have always wondered why he's not been able to develop that overspin like Nathan Lyon has. But I've been following him in the nets leading up to this test match. And you could see that even in the warm-up game at Drummond, he had developed, he had this exaggerated movement of the elbow just before the load up and to almost just cock his wrists. And you could see that he was working on it. And that's going to be Ashwin throughout, like, you know, for however long he plays cricket, he'll always keep evolving. He'll always keep working on, like, you know, his deliveries. He's practices a lot of leg spinners as well, leg breaks as well. He has the carom ball, he has the dusra, he has all sorts of deliveries. But I think the control he showed with that overspin ensured that, like, you know, he ran through the Australian middle order. And like you guys correctly said, happy Ashwin. And an Ashwin who's really found his rhythm early on in a series is a great sign for India. You know, and he's been working on his batting as well. It didn't work out too well for him in this test. But yeah, and if he starts contributing with the bat as well, that would be a huge boost for India as well.
Someone pointed out to me in the lead up to the first test, the stats comparison, averages and strike rate between Ravi Ashwin and Nathan Lyon. And it really surprised me that R. Ashwin has Lyon a better strike rate and a slightly better average as well. A lot mentioned about Lyon being the GOAT and having the most wickets for an off-spinner. Do you feel like that Ravi Ashwin is maybe slightly underrated now because of all of the attention that Nathan Lyon has been getting over the last couple of years?
Oh, definitely. And also, like, Nathan Lyon has bowled more overs than any other bowler in the last decade. So he bowls a lot of overs. And I mean, I enjoy watching Nathan Lyon more than most other bowlers. And Ashwin is the same. I think with Ashwin, what's really happened is he's never had that breakaway series away from home, like where he's had one full series where he's, like, you know, won matches for India or just been consistent. But the last 18 months, if you look at his record, he's been especially since the last Adelaide Oval Test in 2018, he's been way more consistent than he was in the past. And it's been a criticism that's always been leveled against him, maybe fairly to an extent. His numbers away from home haven't been the best. It's kind of unfair because his numbers at home have been extraordinary. Mm. Like, you know, he's like run through sides, all comers. So I guess it also has to do with the fact that Nathan Lyon has won test matches for Australia or set up wins in pretty much every condition there is away from home. And Ashwin's getting there, but this Ashwin, like, you know, and with Ashwin, it's always about rhythm and body language as well. Like, he just feels like he's just like chomping on at the bits to get the ball in his hand. And that's the Ashwin, that's the most dangerous type of R. Ashwin, especially if you're an opposition batsman. And yeah, he's getting his own back now.
Our producers have given us the wind-up about the spin bowling chat, so let's move on and look forward to the rest of the series and the Boxing Day test in Melbourne starting December 26. That's Boxing Day for Antipodean punters. What do you think the impact or the mental impact of a loss like that will have on the Indian side, and what are your expectations for them in terms of their ability to bounce back for Melbourne?
I mean, look, not having someone as inspirational as Virat Kohli, as obvious as this sounds, will be a big loss. But Ajinkya Rahane is quietly aggressive in his own way. I mean, not just because he's a karate black belt and all that, which he was as a child. But he has his own way of captaining teams. He also believes a lot in, like, you know, putting an arm around his teammates' shoulders, really being very, very encouraging on the field. He might not be as emotive as Virat Kohli when he's captaining the side, but he has his own very affirmative style of captaincy. But the thing is, I'm not ruling India out of the series this early, purely because they dominated 65% of that first test, and then it just came down to those 92 minutes of madness that we've spoken about a lot. So I still think it depends a lot on the toss. If India can bat first and get some runs on the board, batting will be a lot easier here as compared to the Adelaide Oval against the pink ball. This is something that they are used to a lot. They have good memories, like I said, of the Boxing Day. The bowling without Shami is, for me, is a bigger concern than the batting, but he's been the enforcer for a while. But well, we don't know what Siraj is like at the test level, so maybe he'll produce something which we don't expect. So, but I'm not ruling India out this early in the piece.
And looking ahead to those other tests, you said about Rohit Sharma before. I saw a little article I think I was reading something yesterday saying that this COVID outbreak might rule him out because he's stuck in Sydney. Have you heard any more about that?
Nah, I mean, I'm about to write a piece on that, guys. But yeah, I'll just give you a little heads up. No, I don't think he's ruled out for the series.
Nice.
Once he is done with his quarantine, I think he should be available for the third test, depending on if he passes the fitness test, which that was made very clear by the BCCI. So if he is fit, I would think he comes in, depending on what happens in Melbourne. Like, if everybody scores runs, then I'm sure they won't force Rohit into the setup. But yeah, having someone with his experience, and he's not really had great tours of Australia in the past. They've been a bit up and down. So if India fail again, then Rohit Sharma might be that savior. But I don't think his series is over yet.
And I guess the COVID stuff, we don't want to ruin break your story too much, but has there been any more chat around kind of the potential of moving tests and, you know, what the contingency plans might be?
It's all up in the air. And I know I'm sounding like a cricket administrator myself there, but it really is. Like, there have been so many theories floated around and, whether it is like, shifting the Brisbane or advancing the Brisbane test and making it the third test and going to Sydney, or keeping it in Melbourne, or going back to Adelaide, which I would appreciate. I've not been home too long at all. Every time I go home, they ask me to leave. So I would appreciate that. But I think Cricket Australia would like to keep the third test in Sydney. But what exactly happens, I think we'll have to wait for at least 3 or 4 more days. The good signs in out of Sydney, the number of cases are reducing, which is good, like overall. I think we'll have to wait 2 or 3 more days for that.
And finally, before we move on from the Boxing Day test in Melbourne, no Virat Kohli, no Mohammad Shami. Who are the key X-factor players that have to step up for India? And what's your prediction for the outcome of the Melbourne test, if you'd care to give one?
Well, I have been very bad with predictions. I predicted India would win the Adelaide Oval test, which I thought I was well on track of getting it right on the morning of the third day, but well, you know what happened after that. But I still think Prithvi Shaw will be persisted with, and he could be the X factor, because India back him to give them the kind of starts that will, like, you know, if he bats for half an hour, you've seen him bat before, he will make 50 runs. It's just a question of, hopefully he can get a little bit of luck early on, not get an unplayable delivery. I still think he's an X factor on the top. Ravindra Jadeja will transform this team on the field, and just with the energy he brings with bat, ball, in the field for sure. It's all up to Rahane now. Like, it is his team. Like, he's the red ball captain of the tour. So his series as captain begins now. And he looked in good touch in that first innings before the run out ruined everything. So Captain Rahane, so much talk of Virat. Captain Rahane might hold the key with the bat. Can we speak about R. Ashwin more? I don't think so, before the producer comes after me. But yeah, the way Ashwin's bowling is a great sign for India, considering the way the MCG and SCG pitches have played in the last few years.
Oh, you can talk about spin as much as you want. We just block that noise out. But before we let you go, I mean, there are a couple of things from your back catalogue that we're really keen to talk about. We mentioned in the intro that you wrote a book titled The Dhoni Touch. I mean, I guess the biggest question I have is what was that experience like writing a book about, you know, someone who's one of the most famous and popular people in a country of 1 billion people? Like, did you feel pressure?
In fact, there was pressure, but not so much because I was writing about someone so famous, but more because he was such an enigmatic fellow. Thankfully, I would not say he was my friend, but I knew him a little bit here and there, like, you know, from all my cricket touring days. And nobody can really say that they know MS Dhoni well, which was the biggest challenge I had to overcome. But thankfully, he obviously didn't give me an interview, but he helped me get in touch with the 3 or 4 people who know the real MS Dhoni. And there are only 3 or 4 people in this whole world who know him really, really well, which really helped. So for me, it was more about getting those elements. Like, you know, I gave myself a challenge to say, okay, I'm going to explain not who MS Dhoni is, but more about why he does the things he does, because he's so different to any Indian cricketer before or after him, and just very different to any Indian before or after him. I think that was the biggest challenge. Once you put MS Dhoni on the cover, guys, the book will sell at least the first few copies. But I'm really glad that people have found it interesting, and even today someone was tweeting about it. So it really does put a smile on my face, because it was a big, big task writing a book, especially when I was writing anyway back then for the newspaper for a day job. But I think it worked out well. And I think I know MS Dhoni a little better than what I did before the book.
Yeah. And I mean, are there any favorite stories that you kind of uncovered from your research?
Oh, I mean, there were plenty, I guess, both on and off the field. Like on the field, for me, the one story that really stood out for me was, you know, in 2007-08 in Australia, in that tri-series when India are just about to win an ODI against Australia at the MCG. It's a small run chase. And he calls a young Rohit Sharma, who is batting with, and he says, "We're not going to celebrate this win." He calls someone, pretends to be calling for a change of gloves, tells the dressing room, "We're not going to celebrate this win. Like, you know, this is like the greatest thing ever." Because Australia at that point were indomitable, right? So every time Australia lost, they almost treated us as an upset. And this was MS Dhoni quietly sending a message to the Australians saying, "Look, we've just won a cricket game, like, you know, which we've dominated from start to end. It's not a big deal." So in fact, he'd even told Rohit Sharma that, you know, when the teams exchange handshakes, just hold your hand very feeble, like don't, like, you know, give them a firm handshake, and just look straight through them, almost like, you know, it's so just a matter of fact win. So that, like, you know, he would do strange things like that, which at the moment wouldn't make sense, but later on when you think about it, like, you know, you would get the rationale behind it. And in that same series, the way the Australians kept sledging some of the Indian players, and one of them said, like, when one of them gave it back, the senior Australian player said, "Oh, show me some respect, mate. Do you know who I am?" And then after that, every time that particular batsman walked out to bat, he would get all the young Indians to hang around the batsman, just keep saying, "Respect, respect, respect, respect. Like, if you want respect, we'll give you respect." So he led India in a very strange fashion. Like, you know, it at times, like I said, people were bemused by what he was doing, but I was glad I could bring that side of him and kind of explain why he was doing these things. And off the field as well, I guess, his interest in the military, which I'd heard about, people have spoken about a lot, but when you actually dig in and you find out that it's not a jingoistic love, it's not like India should win every war, like, you know, it's not that type. Mm. It's actually about how he, deep inside, he wanted to be a soldier, and just how he would be with the soldiers in the camps that he would visit. And just the fact that the first thing he ever did when he visited an army camp was go and stand at the sentry post, because that's generally given to the junior most officer. And you're guarding the rest of the camp at night. So you are responsible for the safety of the whole camp, even though you're junior most. Mm. So things like that, for me, really stood out more than just his batting and his keeping and everything else.
Oh, I mean, he's definitely, you know, even from afar, he's one of the most interesting characters of, you know, of recent times for cricket fans. I mean, he copped a lot of stick during and I guess after this latest IPL. Do you think he can bounce back? Because, I mean, it would feel like a real shame if he didn't somehow find a way to go out on top.
Yeah, I know. He will find a way to go out on top. Trust me on that. Like, he's... Yeah. I mean, his life has been all about timing. He's picked his moments really, really well. I guess, yes. I mean, maybe has he like outlasted his welcome a bit with some Indian fans will tell you that. But, you know, regardless of where the next IPL is played, whether it's in India or the UAE, he would want to bow out with an IPL in India. Mm-hmm. So that would be his perfect dream. And, you know, the way his life has been, I wrote that piece when he officially announced his retirement a few months ago. It's all about timing, and he will eventually get the timing right, is what I believe. So yeah, don't write him off as yet.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I know you've spoken about the story in the past. You type in your name in Google, and the story of Patrick Patterson comes up. I mean, but the journey that you went through to track down, the former West Indian fast bowler, Patrick Patterson, 6 or 7 years. I mean, it's such a brilliant story. We can't have you on and not talk about it. I'll put a link to the show notes for any listeners who haven't read it, because they absolutely should. But I mean, can you kind of explain what made you set out on this mission to track him down?
Oh, firstly, thanks, guys. Thanks for the kind words. Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, my first tour to the Caribbean. That name, Patrick Patterson, had always stuck with me. I didn't watch much of him. I was too young to watch him at his peak, which was like for 2 or 3 years in the late 80s, in the early 90s. I watched a bit of him, but you know, the fact that when I went there for the first time, nobody knew where he was. Like, you know, people would say random things. He was lost in the bush and this and that, but nobody had seen him. This is what got me really, really intrigued. And I mean, like I write in the piece, every time I went there, subsequently, it became like a mission for me in life, weirdly. So the next time around, of course, I met his parents. And when I found them in some little village in central Jamaica. And when they told me that they had no idea where he was, I was like, well, I don't know why, but I think I need to find this guy. And, you know, yes, I mean, like a lot of people have spoken about the story. And of course, I guess it's kind of become my claim to fame in a way. But for me, what that story did was like much more than what, like, you know, I wrote. The fact that I could become a window into the world for someone, forget about the fact that he was a famous cricketer at one point, but just the fact that he's been literally living by himself for 25 years with no window into the outside world, like not knowing what is happening in the world. The fact that subsequently, ever since I wrote that story and I met him, I've been able to become that window, like whether it's telling him about the virus or explaining to him what social media is, or just talking to him about, like, you know, his own feats. And I still spend a lot of time speaking to him on the phone, checking up on him and finding different ways of helping him get his memory back. Like, you know, one thing I did discover a few months ago is if I start reading out scoreboards to him, like matches that he was a part of, it, when I take names of players, it kind of helps him get some memory back. So for me, it's almost like, you know, I owe a lot to him, you know, in a strange way. Like, you know, we share a very strange relationship, I guess, but one that I really, really cherish. And you know, I mean, that's what we all live for, right? To bring a change in somebody's life. And if you're able to do that, like, what better than that? So yes, the story was great. Like, I really enjoyed doing it. The interesting characters that I met en route to finding him, which I mentioned all of them in the piece. But it has become much more than that since then.
Oh, I'm really pleased that was going to be my follow-up, really, because it sort of had, when I'm reading the article, I don't know if you've seen the movie Searching for Sugar Man. It felt like that, where it's about the musician Rodriguez, and kind of he became this viral sensation in South Africa from a cassette tape, and you know, he was just living in Detroit and he didn't know that this was happening. And yeah, he, you know, it wasn't quite the same as Patrick's story, but you know, similar sort of story where he was just, I guess, living a loner life and something was going on outside of his control, and all these stories were floating around similar to Patrick about what you know, that he died in these terrible accidents and all these things. And then when they finally did track him down, he was really unaware of them. So I'm really pleased that to know that, you know, you've managed to maintain that relationship. That's fantastic.
Oh, thanks so much, guys. Yeah, I'm not watched the movie, but a lot of people have told me that there are similarities between the story, like what I wrote about Patterson and the movie. But it's something which has always been on my radar to watch. Almost watched it like 3 weeks ago, actually, when I was, or last month when I was home. But someday I will make time out for it. But yeah, thank you so much for, like, you know, just talking about the part that, like, you know, where the relationship that we formed about with each other after the story. I mean, that is journalist Bharat Sundaresan. But I'll be honest, even while I was talking to him, like, you know, while I was there with him, after a point, it didn't really matter whether I was going to write the story or not. Mm. And I've always said that the reason, and I've been very uncomfortable writing, bringing me into the story, like, you know, saying, using the word I in any story, because as journalists, we're just chroniclers, right? It's not about us. The only reason I did that was to avoid people just forming opinions about the man. Like, and I wanted it to be about me finding him, not, oh, look, this is Patrick Patterson, this is the state he's in, because then people just jump to conclusions about him. And I thought that would have been unfair. So yeah, I mean, it's been a very interesting journey, like, you know, finding him. And also, like I said, since finding him, the bond we've formed.
Oh, yeah, I think, as I said before, I think you did a wonderful job of it. And I think that's probably a great way to wrap up the podcast. I mean, but before we do that, I mean, are you working on anything? You mentioned that the story that you're working on right now, but I mean, are you working on anything big that you'd like to give a shout out to? Or, you know, do you want to just let people know where they can find you and your work?
I'm not working on anything major right now. My focus is on this series. And basically, I think I'm done with road trips for this summer. Really, I don't want to be making any more escapes from one state to the other. I got my COVID test done yesterday and it came negative. So phew, thank God for that. I mean, they can find my work on Crick Bus, which is who I write for these days. But I'm always popping up here and there, like, you know, telling stories on whether it's on radio or TV. I'm doing some work for SEN during the series, doing commentary. Thank you for having me on. And it was great fun catching up with you guys. And next time I'm in New Zealand, we're going to get together and talk spin, aren't we?
That sounds fantastic. That's music to my ears. Bharat Sundarasan, thank you very much for your time on the Top Order podcast.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a great evening.
Thanks for tuning in to the Top Order podcast. Before you disappear from our feed, if you're a new listener, please do go and check out the back catalogue. We've spoken recently to New Zealand coach Gary Stead. We've got Graham Thorpe. We've got Shane Dietz. We've got Barry Richards, Shane Bond, Colin Miller, all in the back catalogue. You can find the details www.thetoporderpodcast.com. We're the Top Order Podcast on Instagram, although we're still really figuring that out. We're at Top Order Pod on Facebook and Twitter, so don't be shy to jump on, give our tweets a share or a retweet, and we'll see you next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.